Friday was Parking Day in San Francisco. An art collective started the event 5 years ago to draw attention to urban land use issues. What happens is the group reclaims metered parking spaces and puts down grass, trees, and even benches onto what normally is just asphalt. Sarus Farivar reports from San Francisco on an unusual installation.
On any given day, San Francisco's 2nd Street doesn't look or sound much different than any other moderately busy street in the South of Market neighborhood. Most people just walk right past the usual parking meters. But on Friday, J.J. Toothman stopped dead in his tracks on his way to the office.
I work about a block and a half that way. And, just ran into the curiosity of miniature golf on the side of the road. You know, who can deny that?
Yes, miniature golf on a busy street. This was just one of 30-odd parking day installations around San Francisco. There were similar setups in other global cities, including Los Angeles, Chicago, Auckland, Seoul, and Warsaw. This one, built by Blanket Collaborative, a group of architects and designers here, had 3 holes of miniature golf built onto a self-contained platform. The whole thing fit precisely into one standard parking space. At various points, Douglas Rooney, one of the organizers, had to feed the meter.
We figure it's our obligation. If we're taking the space today, it's going to be about $40 for the day.
Without missing a beat, Toothman grabbed a neon green golf ball, a club, and teed up, scanning for the hole on the other side of the parking spot, with traffic whizzing by him just a few feet away.
So where's the, it's way over there? All right, here we go.
In this case, though, instead of AstroTurf, the green was made of a hodgepodge of carpet samples. Toothman scanned down the 20 or so feet. He'd have to bank it off the corner angle to make the hole around a blind corner, but his shot wasn't bad.
So I'm about 18 inches from the hole. I got the putter out. That's a 2.
For the record, par on this hole was 2, but his last 2 holes weren't nearly as good.
Probably went 6 over for 3 holes. That kind of illustrates why I don't play golf.
Still, though, he seemed to enjoy his few minutes of shooting 3 holes of golf on 2nd Street.
That's a nice way to spend a Friday morning.
At the end of the day, the architects packed up the course, returning this parking space to its natural state. Just another meter marking about 150 square feet of street. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar in San Francisco.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
There were hopes that President Obama would signal big changes today in the way the U.S. deals with climate change. That's what many leaders from other developed nations were hoping for. Joining us now to talk about international reaction to Mr. Obama's speech is NPR's Richard Harris. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Robert.
You listened to the speeches that followed the president's. What sense did you get from those speeches of how the president was received?
Well, Mr. Obama is very popular, and he got a nice warm round of applause when he was done. I think he scored points for fully acknowledging that global warming is a huge and serious issue. But there was a lot of frustration that he didn't say more, that he didn't put something new on the table in a big way from the United States. I listened to France President Nicolas Sarkozy, who gave one of the speeches later on, and he even sounded angry. In his speech, he even referred to empty speeches. He didn't mention Mr. Obama per se, but his frustration level at the pace of climate talks was clearly just through the roof.
Well, what would the Europeans actually have wanted President Obama to say?
Well, what the Europeans would really like is for Mr. Obama to step up and make bold promises to slash U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide. But let me take you back to the Kyoto climate talks in 1997. The Clinton administration essentially did make those bold promises in Kyoto. They brought them back to Washington, D.C., and it was a dead letter because, remember, any treaty needs 67 votes in the Senate. And that's a huge challenge to get 67 people agreeing on anything, senators. So Mr. Obama's strategy is try to get domestic climate legislation through the Senate first to find out what the Senate is willing to stand behind and then bring them climate legislation. So the timing is very unfortunate in terms of the global climate talks, but he doesn't want to end up where we were after Kyoto in 1997.
And what's been heard from China, which actually produces even more emissions than the U.S. does?
Yes, well, President Hu Jintao of China gave a speech here today also, and it was billed in advance as a blockbuster. But I think people who've been tracking what's been up with China didn't hear very much at all new in that speech. What China is up to is it does have ambitious domestic climate plans. They're not ambitious enough actually to reduce the emissions from China, but they're enough to slow them down. But President Hu Jintao did not make any promises really regarding an international deal. And so it doesn't seem like what he said would really break the logjam that we're seeing in the current climate talks.
Any other interesting speakers from other parts of the world?
Well, the speaker who followed Mr. Obama was the president of the Maldives, their low-lying island state. And he sort of half-jokingly said that, you know, he's always asked to come to events like this to remind people that his country actually could disappear under the waves if sea level rises as much as it could easily in the next century or two. So it was an impassioned plea basically to act before it's too late. And the other impassioned speech came from the leader of Rwanda, who basically reminded everyone that the poorest countries in the world really suffer the most, even though they are least responsible for global warming. And he was advocating a very substantial transfer of wealth, essentially, from the rich countries to the poor countries as a way to help the poor countries take care of the problems that the rich countries have created.
Richard, this is all in preparation for the climate talks in December in Copenhagen. And does today at the UN give you any indication of what's likely to happen there in December?
Well, I think that it's pretty clear that there's not going to be an enormous breakthrough that will make Copenhagen a resounding success in the terms that people are all hoping for. I mean, the countries of the world are in agreement that there should be a climate treaty, that we need to do something about global warming. The issue is that they're on an extremely tight deadline to make things happen in Copenhagen. It doesn't seem as though they're going to make an enormous amount of progress between now and December.
Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure.
That's NPR's Richard Harris at the United Nations.
We're taking a look this week at an old energy source that's getting new attention, natural gas. New production techniques now make it possible to get gas out of underground rock formations. As a result, there is more accessible natural gas in the United States than people ever thought was possible. And here's a fact. Most natural gas is produced by small, independent companies. This is one game where big oil got beat. NPR's Tom Jelton has the story.
Not long ago, it seemed the United States was running out of natural gas. The big oil companies got out of the U.S. gas business partly for that reason. But then gas producers figured out how to get gas out of shale rock. That opened up whole new opportunities. In the backwoods of West Virginia, near Clarksburg, for example, Randy Sleeth has a crew digging a gas well.
You look at the number of companies that are here from other states, everybody's, you know, kind of flocking to the Appalachian Basin.
Sleeth has been drilling gas wells in West Virginia for 30 years, but he's never seen so much outside interest in the local gas deposits.
People from out west starting up new businesses here pretty much on a monthly basis.
Randy Sleeth is under contract to Gastar Exploration, a small Texas company with only 23 full-time employees, none of them on the East Coast. It's not an unusual situation. The energy world as a whole is dominated by a handful of enormous oil companies, but the U.S. natural gas business is a notable exception. 82% of all U.S. natural gas is produced by small, independent companies with just a dozen employees on average. In part, this is a story about how innovation occurs, at least in this industry. Robert Hefner is a 50-year veteran of the natural gas business and has a company of his own, GHK Exploration, in Oklahoma City.
The major oil companies haven't been paying any attention to the U.S. for decades, really since the 60s and 70s. And it's been a lot of independents like us that have found all this gas, developed the technology, and made it happen.
Hefner says one reason small companies have come to play such a big role in the U.S. natural gas business is because individual landowners here generally retain their own mineral rights. They can get a gas well drilled on their own property.
In America, if that's the dream is to drill a well, you can go out and drill a well. As a result, there's been about 3.5 million wells been drilled in America over the years versus about 1.5 million for the rest of the world.
Many U.S. gas wells are mom-and-pop operations. Often they merge, evolving into slightly larger companies, but even the publicly traded gas companies are generally small. Take Gastar, the Texas company behind the gas well in Clarksburg, West Virginia. Russell Porter, the company chairman, says Gastar has had to learn how to compete with the big energy companies.
We certainly don't have an advantage when it comes to capital. The large companies can spend a lot more money than we can, but we can be very quick on the draw, if you will, to seize an opportunity and to buy into a new concept or a new area that we think could be prospective for natural gas. And if we do that, then we've usually got a first mover advantage.
There's also a practical reason small companies dominate the U.S. natural gas business. Typically, a new gas well produces in abundance in the year after it's opened, but production then begins to decline sharply. If a natural gas company is to keep production steady, it has to keep drilling new wells. This routine of constant drilling of small wells generally is not something that has interested the big oil companies. Patrick McGinn is a spokesman for Exxon's exploration business.
With a company our size, we have to have a larger scale. We have to have a potential resource that has more capability for us to go after.
The natural gas business, in fact, is a good way to look at how business strategies differ for companies depending on their size. First, on the small end, a company like Gastar Exploration, with its 23 employees down in Texas, proceeds cautiously when it starts up a new operation far from home. This brings us back to Clarksburg, West Virginia, where Randy Sleeth and his crew are digging a well for Gastar.
Right now we're close to 1,700 feet down. We will be getting into the shale around 3,000 feet in this area.
This is actually a relatively shallow gas well. Most shale gas wells are deeper, and they turn to proceed horizontally across a shale layer. Those deep wells are becoming the norm in this part of the country, which is home to the enormous Marcellus shale formation. Gastar's well drilling operation is basically the minimum the company can do to establish a foothold in the area. This is part of the Gastar strategy. Chairman Russell Porter says his company, because it's small, likes to let other companies take the lead in a new area and learn from their experience.
Let them drill some of the early wells, try to determine which drilling techniques work the best, which completion techniques work the best. And then once that they've done that trial and error and sort of established a pattern that works, we can go in and design our wells without having the trial and error phase, which can be very expensive in a new play.
The issue of how to handle risk is big in any new industrial venture. In the natural gas business, the smallest companies may, in some ways, be the most adventurous. The new investments they make are tiny compared to what a large company can make. But they'll still try to shift as much of the risk as they can to their larger rivals. Paradoxically, the biggest energy companies also try to transfer the risk, only they'd like to put it on the smaller companies. And right now, because shale production in the United States looks so promising, big oil is thinking about getting back into the natural gas game. Patrick McGinn says Exxon is looking at some possible shale plays in the U.S. right now, but just like Gastar, it's biding its time before making a big move.
We've taken a couple of years to really work on the technology that's required to do the exploration and production of these kinds of shale plays. And so doing the homework and doing the technology development takes some time for us, and we were willing to wait for that.
And what would happen to a little company like Gastar were Exxon to move onto its territory, like in the Marcellus Formation in West Virginia or Pennsylvania? Russell Porter says his company will still have its niche on the fringes if necessary, or it could just let big oil take over its operations.
If Exxon came in and wanted to become a dominant player in the Marcellus Shale, I'm sure there are lots of small operators who would be willing to sell out to them if they were willing to pay full value. And then there's always going to be another play for us to go and invest in and sort of start creating value all over again.
It's all part of the natural gas game. There is one big downside to the fact that small, independent companies still dominate the U.S. natural gas industry. It's harder for them to speak with one voice, and that's important if they are to address concerns about the impact of shale gas drilling on the environment, or if they're to be well represented in Washington when energy legislation is written. That story tomorrow. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
We're glad you're hearing this story on this public radio station. And when you're checking the news throughout the day at NPR.org, you can also learn more about U.S. energy consumption and the quest for shale gas.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West in California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Houston. A signpost here amid the Houston skyscrapers suggests how much this giant city has changed. The sign says that in 1836, the founders of Houston set aside this city block on Texas Street. It was the Church Reserve, dedicated to religious activity. Today, the churches have moved. An office building stands here instead. Houston is a city in motion, and it uses enormous amounts of energy. This morning, we'll talk with a mayor who wants to move the city toward energy efficiency. It's our latest report from the urban frontier, our occasional look at how cities change and grow. We begin in a Houston driveway, the start of Mayor Bill White's morning commute.
How y'all doing? Good
morning. He slips into the car carrying a black mug of coffee and a sheet of papers. He's a soft-spoken man without a lot of hair and with a steady gaze. We ride through a park full of joggers. Then we detour onto a city block with a jumble of houses, old and new.
You have an innovation that you don't have where you would have a much more top-down taste patrol.
Houston has no zoning code, so it has a lot of variety. On this street, we pass shotgun shacks and big front porches and modernistic new row houses.
And then just roll here for 1 second to what's on the left, which we call a beer can house, where a guy built a house and decided that he was going to decorate the inside and out with beer cans.
The house is now a museum to that one man's highly personal taste.
His habit required him to consume large amounts of beer to generate those cans. And it was hard work, but somebody had to do it.
Mayor White says he wants to do the hard work of changing this freewheeling place. He's a former Deputy Secretary of Energy. And here in America's energy capital, he made that one of his signature issues. All those long commutes and all those big air-conditioned houses use a lot of energy.
We need a dramatic reduction in the energy consumed per square foot occupied in structures if we are going to continue to grow and reduce emissions, including carbon emissions.
Which the city tried to do by subsidizing an affordable house. The mayor took us to see it. It stands near a freight railroad line, but has excellent insulation and a solar panel on the roof. Sometimes the panel generates even more electricity than the residents consume.
What are the possibilities for a place like this? I mean, this is one house in one neighborhood, but do you envision thousands of houses like this?
There could be thousands here, and there could be millions. Something like this, I would think, in 10 years, could be the standard for new home construction in this country. And if we did that, then this whole debate about whether we should have more from coal or more from nuclear or rising utility bills would all be moot.
Bill White hopes the example will inspire developers to build efficient homes on their own. But this city spreads over hundreds of square miles. People use a lot of energy on their long commutes. And there are limits to what Bill White can do or wants to do to force change. Those who think the mayor could have done more include a man who joined us on Houston's light rail line. We took a ride with Jay Crosley of an advocacy group called Houston Tomorrow.
This goes all the way out to the Astrodome. Now there's the Reliant Stadium.
The shiny silver trains are just a few years old, and more lines are planned.
And in 2013, you'll be able to live in all over town and basically live a full life via light rail.
Which means that some people in America's oil capital could have the option to use less oil by leaving the car at home. Crosley can look out the window, though, and see one problem. There's a lot of vacant land along the rail line. For a variety of reasons, developers have not yet rushed to build within walking distance of the train stops. Crosley thinks part of the problem is that Mayor White, like all Houston officials before him, did relatively little urban planning. There is a variety of land use regulations, which don't always make sense to Crosley.
There's a whole sort of anti-clutter, anti-billboard movement that is actually very powerful. They recently made the city council pass a law against those inflatable gorillas because that was a huge problem, apparently, and it made our city look bad, apparently. So that kind of thing is completely okay, whereas doing a comprehensive plan is seen as socialism or as inappropriate.
Houston's lack of zoning limits the city's power. It relies more on private restrictions on property deeds, which vary widely. Local business leader Dan Bello likes it that way. We spoke on the balcony of his 25th floor office, looking out over clusters of skyscrapers that have spread across Houston.
And I think there's a lot of urban planners today who would come to Houston and say, nah, I don't like this at all, and others who come and say, you know what, this worked a lot better, because what it did was it allowed for competition to stay in the market. In other words, zoning restricts competition, makes it harder to permit, to build, and deliver product to the market. In Houston, it's a little easier to do that. We have fewer barriers to entry.
Yet some city leaders have begun asking if they need a few more barriers. Two developers proposed to build a tower in the middle of a low-rise residential neighborhood. It would rise 23 stories. Private homes were right across the street. Developer Matthew Morgan said he wanted to include a store, a restaurant, an office space, as well as apartments.
With the objective being to reduce the dependence on the automobile.
You must have had a sense that if you were going to build a 23-story building next to much lower houses, that somebody was going to be unhappy about that.
Well, we did. I mean, yes, we anticipated, I guess, what I generally refer to as some pushback.
In fact, neighbors were outraged about the size of the building and the possible growth in traffic. Today, the neighborhood is full of yellow signs proclaiming Stop the Ashby. That's the name of the building. Mayor Bill White took the side of the residents. The developers finally had to take the stores and offices out of their proposal to get a permit.
And by forcing us to remove these uses, this has become more or less another residential high-rise project.
Opponents of this project say it's simply in the wrong place, and the story underlines the complexities of making any city greener. The mayor sat down to talk over these issues in a new city park. Kids are playing soccer on a brilliant green lawn. Bill White is preparing to leave the mayor's office after 6 years. He's term limited, and he's running for the U.S. Senate as a Democrat. He gestures toward an energy-efficient skyscraper under construction nearby. When it comes to energy use, is Houston sustainable right now?
Well, I mean, what I look at is something very simple. Have we broken the almost one-to-one correlation between economic growth and power consumption for residences? And on that, the answer is a resounding yes.
Explain that one-to-one correlation. I think people may be interested
yes.
in what that historic pattern
well,
is.
Well, that means that as the national productivity goes up by 1%, the power consumption goes up by 1%. And this happens all over the world as you have a rising middle class. More people have more financial independence. They occupy more square footage. Generally, as a standard of living goes up, then our power consumption has gone up. Our goal was to break the link between economic growth and growth in power consumption.
This growing city will strain to keep that goal long after Mayor Bill White leaves office. From California and from Houston, Texas, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today's United Nations meeting on climate change could be seen as a pep rally. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants to pump up enthusiasm for a climate treaty. It's supposed to be finished in December in Copenhagen, but it's in deep trouble. In a moment, we'll hear NPR's Juan Williams on the domestic politics of climate change. We start with NPR's Richard Harris.
Climate change is a hard problem. An effective treaty would eventually require the global economy to change directions entirely, with a shift away from fossil fuels and toward cleaner sources of energy. There's at least serious talk about starting that transition. The United States is a key player, and the House of Representatives passed a bill that is intended to move in that direction. But the issue is stalled in the Senate. Jason Grumet at the Bipartisan Policy Center says there are three main reasons for that.
The global recession, the extent to which the healthcare debate has now really crowded out all other political activity, and the deep mistrust that people in our Congress and across our country now have about market-based approaches to problem solving.
The idea of creating vast new markets to buy and sell carbon emissions suddenly sounds like not such a great idea, since exotic markets in bundled mortgages nearly led to economic collapse a year ago. Grumet says given time, there are ways to solve these problems.
The real challenge, though, is getting beyond the kind of vitriol that is now marking our larger political discussion, because if that remains, you know, I think we're going to find ourselves not making progress on any of the important issues facing the country.
And time is running short. Congress needs to agree on a domestic climate policy before the Obama administration can negotiate a credible international deal. And it's looking like there simply won't be time to come up with a climate bill before December, when the next climate treaty is supposed to be negotiated in Copenhagen.
But U.S. isn't the only problem.
Kelly Sims Gallagher at Tufts University says China is also an impediment. The Chinese government is demanding that the industrialized world make drastic cuts in its emissions before China agrees to reduce its own. Gallagher says this is not helpful.
But we have to understand China's stance as a negotiating position right now.
Countries often talk tough as a deadline approaches. She says, time's up. The United States and China, which are by far the two biggest contributors to global warming, need to sit down together and start getting serious.
If they don't start doing that this week, it's hard to imagine being able to have enough time to get through all of the contentious issues and come out of Copenhagen with an agreement.
If you ask David Victor at the University of California, San Diego, about the prospects of a deal by December...
Well, they're looking pretty bad.
The lack of U.S. domestic legislation is a big blow. So's the global economy. Rich countries don't have much money to offer the developing world, and money is what developing countries expect from these talks to help them cope with the consequences of climate change. So Victor is among a rising chorus of voices saying it's time to start thinking seriously about Plan B.
I think what needs to happen between now and Copenhagen is the diplomats need to sift through this huge list of issues on which they can't agree and find the small list of items where they can agree and where, if they fail to agree, there's going to be a big harmful impact on climate diplomacy.
For example, put in writing promises countries have already made so they don't back away from them. And don't expect to negotiate global emissions reduction targets.
And then develop a very distinct game plan for the 2 or 3 years following the Copenhagen process.
He says the worst-case scenario would be if nations lower their expectations for Copenhagen so much that nothing happens, yet everyone declares victory and goes home. Richard Harris, NPR News.
The lagoon surrounding the 1,300-year-old island city of Venice is the site of an ambitious engineering project. It involves the construction of mobile floodgates aimed at safeguarding one of the world's most endangered cities. But some scientists say the project may not be enough to protect Venice from rising sea levels caused by climate change. NPR's Silvia Poggioli has this report.
Venice rose from mudflats in the middle of a lagoon which forms the largest wetland in the Mediterranean. The island city has been subject to increasing flooding due to sinking land but also to rising sea levels. It's known as acqua alta, high water, which brings city life to a standstill for several hours. Big boats can't go under low-hanging bridges and water seeps into buildings through the sewage system. Venetians have not lived on the ground floor for decades. Sophisticated technology is now being used for what has become a full-scale emergency. At one of the three inlets that lead from the sea into the lagoon, a massive mechanical hammer is driving a steel and concrete piling into the lagoon bed. Elena Zambardi works for the consortium Safeguarding Venice. She says the use of pilings was invented by the visionaries who founded the city 1,300 years ago.
In Venice, for example, under the Salute Church and the Rialto Bridge, there are piles, wooden piles, to consolidate the subsoil.
The project acronym is MOSE, which is also the Italian word for Moses, recalling the biblical parting of the sea. Once completed in 2014, there will be 78 large mobile floodgates at the three inlets. When not in use, they'll lay below water on the lagoon bed. When a high tide is forecast, Zambardi says, the gates will rise and shut off the sea from the lagoon.
And Moses will defend Venice if the sea level rises up to 60 centimeters.
But the project, which is 54% completed, has been hounded by controversy, and critics say may already be outdated. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has forecast a sea level rise by the end of this century of between 18 and 59 centimeters. But scientists caution it could be even higher. Marine scientist Laura Carbonin has been studying the Venetian Lagoon for decades. Like many scientists, she fears rising sea levels could mean the floodgates will be closed often and for long periods. That would upset the vital exchange between the sea and the lagoon, suffocating its delicate ecosystem. Carbonin co-authored a report that suggests another radical solution.
To complement the MOSES solution, it is necessary that all the city is uplifted.
She says research already suggests the feasibility of raising Venice.
Based on hydrogeological and geochemical data, the preliminary simulation show that fluid injection into deep formation can uniformly raise Venice up to 30 centimeters over 10 years.
Carbonin hypothesizes injections of salt water or even carbon dioxide at a depth of 600 to 800 meters below the lagoon. But she concedes much more research is needed. That would mean huge investments at a time when delays in state funding for the $6 billion plus MOSES have already substantially delayed the project's completion. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.